In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer Dr. John Connolly goes behind the scenes with Dr. Mako, a physician and professor of pediatrics and medicine at Stanford University and center director for the Pisces Center at Stanford Medicine. Cancer immunotherapy has ignited a profound shift in cancer treatment, rendering some once deadly malignancies into manageable chronic diseases. Dr. Crystal Mako, a pioneering cancer immunotherapy researcher, has been at the forefront of these advances. Get ready to go from bench to fireside with an eye-opening look at the past, present, and future of cancer immunotherapy as informed through the scientific-led experiences of Dr. Mako.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Crystal Mako.
So I do want to welcome Dr. Crystal Mako, the Center Director of PICE at Stanford Medicine. Crystal is also the Ernest and Emilio Gallo Family Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine at Stanford University, founding director of the Stanford Center for Cancer Cell Therapy, and associate director of the Stanford Cancer Institute, and leader of the Cancer Immunotherapy Program at Stanford. So clearly incredibly focused and someone that I have tremendous admiration for and incredibly dedicated cancer immunotherapist. Just diving in a little bit, prior to this, maybe just some background for everybody. You were at NCI for quite a long time, for maybe 27 years, and finished really as the chief of pediatric oncology branch. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background, maybe the career trajectory?
First of all, thanks for the very kind words, John. When young folks ask me, how did I get to where I am? I say, don't follow mine. It's a little bit strange. I actually was a physician long before I was a scientist, which is unusual today. Most physician scientists start training as scientists often as early as high school. I always knew I wanted to be a doctor, and I ended up attending a medical school in Ohio that was down the road. It was the most economic one. It was a six-year program, and it was geared towards community medicine. Mm-hmm. So fast forward today, it wouldn't be what you would have expected. So I think about it a lot, about how it ended up this way. And the thread that is constant throughout is really an innate curiosity. I was always intrigued by the problem of cancer, both because of its emotional toll on people, its terroristic qualities. You could, you know, remember when a young child was diagnosed with leukemia in my town, went from perfectly healthy to, this was in the 60s, didn't survive. And so cancer for me was always the emperor of all maladies. And so there was not any question that I was going to become a cancer doctor. Even in those days, this was the 80s, and here I was really working in cancer in community hospitals in Akron, Ohio, the oncologists all knew that what we were doing was foolhardy. There was an immense amount of frustration. And there was a belief at that time, really, I got lots of messages around immunotherapy from them. This belief that there must be something going on in the immune system. They would have anecdotal stories and this and that. And I started working with an immunologist at the Akron General Hospital. And we would get tumors that were resected, mostly from colons, and go back to the lab when I didn't have much to do on the wards and try to harvest lymphocytes and study them. So I was really a believer from the early days that surely we could do something with the immune system. In 1984, I remember I read Steve Rosenberg's New England Journal paper reporting on a series of patients that received IL-2 for melanoma. And here was a drug that didn't touch the tumor. It treated the immune system, and he demonstrated regression. So for me, it was clear what I wanted to do, but it wasn't until 1989 that I went to NCI. I always give the NIH immense credit for taking a chance on me. I didn't look like the typical resume. I didn't have the pedigree, but they gave me a chance and taught me how to become a scientist, which required 6 years of my life dedicated in the lab. I was really a card-carrying physician at that point and went into the lab for 6 years fairly uninterrupted. And I was able to do that in the experimental immunology branch, where people like Laurie Glimcher and Jeff Bluestone trained and was mentored by Ron Gress, who really just taught me so much about science, not only how to do it, but the culture of science. So anyway, I could talk all day, but
It's great. I mean, it's such an amazing environment that you came up in. And I think you see this a lot with leaders in the field, is that there's a lot of mentoring that it's really where your mentor, who you mentor by and where you're at. And that environment is absolutely essential for setting the tone for the rest of your career. And so with that, you're now directing this big center at Stanford. And so how do you see that as a place for people? And clearly Stanford's got an incredible history in the immunotherapy field, going in with some amazing discoveries and innovative work that's been done. But now you're there, you're building that center. What is it that you do to mentor that next generation?
Sure. That is exactly the point, isn't it, John? Because the truth is, our greatest contribution is our legacy. And in science, your legacy is the knowledge you create that gets handed down and is validated. So you start to think about things like that and really look around and ask yourself, are you imparting that knowledge, not only the nuts and bolts of it, but again, it's the culture. And it's the inquisitive spirit,
right?
The curiosity for curiosity's sake, because science is a challenging career trajectory, right? Challenging career choice. There are lots of risks and there are lots of hurdles. And I meet lots of young people who are perfectly poised for impact in science, but who question, is this the career path I should take? Why should I go a career path where things aren't guaranteed when I could go and become a physician and have a comfortable life? I meet a lot of physician scientists who struggle with that. And at the end of the day, that doggone curiosity, if you're just, you can't quit thinking about maybe if we did this or how is this working really? So I try to cultivate that because it's really that satisfaction you get when you've made an important discovery. You might or might not receive the kudos from the community that you hope for. Your grant might yet get rejected and your paper might not end up in the journal you hoped. But at the end of the day, that personal satisfaction is really what you have to cultivate in scientists, because there's no guarantee that it's going to be a great ride.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is just that personal thing that keeps you going. I remember talking to Jim, we were talking about what drove him. And there's a time period when something is discovered in the lab where you're the only one in the world that knows how that works. It's a really short period of time. But that moment of discovery is really what drives him all the way. And it resonated. Creating an environment where young people can learn to feel that and learn to hunger for that is really what drives this entire thing forward, because that doesn't go away. No matter where you are or whether the grant's rejected or not, or whether the paper gets in or not, it's still there. That discovery happens. So it keeps you going. So it's amazing. And the Pisces Center at Stanford and the work that you're doing is one of the big keys, I think, to it is a lot of the technology that you've brought to the table to give us a lot of high resolution understanding of the immune response, the human immune response to both cancer itself and then therapy. Could you talk a little bit about how that works and how the data that's produced really teaches us about cancer immunotherapy and efficacy?
Let me step back a moment. And in preface to answering that question, I think the most important thing that I was taught at NCI, besides learning how to become a scientist, which is obvious, but I had the real privilege of firsthand experience around translation. And from the very early days in my work, I first worked on T-cell homeostasis and then went on to do more immunotherapy trials. But while I was studying mouse models, I was always studying patients at the same time. And I really became a believer, this conducting a fundamental research program alongside a clinical research program and connecting those dots. There's a lot of conversation about translation, but most people think of translation as making a discovery at the bench and getting it to the clinic. And yeah, that's a piece of it. But it's really more of an iterative cycle. And the thing gets really powerful when you have those things happening simultaneously and you have groups of people talking to each other and sharing data. All of that is to say that it's hard to translate. It takes infrastructure. It takes money. It takes a culture at an institution that believes in it because there is risk involved. And I was, I think, lucky to be able to experience that at NCI. So 27 years later, right? I'd come out from my experience knowing a fair amount about how you take a discovery to the clinic. And At that point, it was 2016, I was convinced, it's pretty obvious, that cellular therapies were going to move from a boutique therapy available only at a very large academic medical center or a government hospital to a real therapy for real people. And for me, that was so exciting. I could imagine CAR T cells being given in the community hospitals that I trained in during residency. And that, wow. So I wanted to go somewhere where I could be part of that revolution, experience it, see it be rolled out as a real therapy, but also then contribute, because you need scale. And that was going to happen in a large academic medical center. So for me, Stanford was a perfect playground. It had that amazing, deep, fundamental science, just an elite research institution, world class. And in the last 20 years, it had also become a clinical powerhouse. Mm-hmm. Historically, it wasn't, but they had really decided that was something they wanted to prioritize. But the clinical enterprises and the fundamental enterprises hadn't quite linked up in my vision. Certainly, Ron Levy clearly had done a lot of translational work here in cancer immunotherapy, but there was a lot more to do. And so I came to Stanford because I saw the building blocks present, but I thought they aren't quite synergizing the way they could. And I thought that's how I could add something to this amazing place. And so exactly as you're suggesting, have really sought to take the deep, all of the computational science, the novel technologies, the strong data infrastructure, and use it to advance understanding of cellular therapies. And I think it's working. I don't create new technologies, and I'm not a data scientist. But when I meet somebody who is, I say, aha, that's the one I want.
It's essential, though. And it's essential, actually, to have a team, a true team with different expertise that's coming together around a core problem to make real progress. One person can't do it all. It's just not.
Absolutely.
Wrong. Another area that, and it's clear from your career, is your focus on pediatric oncology. And this is something that you're such a champion for. What brought you there in terms of pediatrics, and what are the problems that we're facing now relative to, say, adult cancers?
A problem that is near and dear to my heart. And in 1989, when I started my oncology fellowship, my biggest question for myself was, do I want to be an adult oncologist or a pediatric oncologist? I actually did med peds in residency. And I ultimately chose pediatric oncology because at the time, it was such a promising field. In other words, we were riding a wave of dramatic progress from the 70s to the 80s. And adult oncology was, frankly, the medical oncologists didn't cure many patients. The surgical oncologists did and the radiation oncologists did, but the medical oncologists didn't. And you want to go somewhere where you feel like you can make a difference. So there I was. I said, okay, I'm going pediatric oncology. And the crazy thing is, John, here we are 30 years later, and pediatric oncology, sadly, looks for all the world a lot like it did in 1989. We know a lot more about what makes the pediatric cancers tick. We've made immense progress in understanding biology, but it hasn't translated into novel, safer, more effective therapies, which is exactly the opposite of adult oncology. In adult oncology, we also learned what made the tumors tick, and the recipe worked. Invest in basic science, and the therapeutics will follow. I think, by all accounts, this recipe is probably the most established for cancer, adult oncology, right? Targeted therapeutics, immunotherapies, et cetera. So what went wrong? Why is that happening? It's easy to say biology, and some of it is biology. Pediatric cancers have less mutated kinase mutations and driver mutations and signaling pathways that can be targeted with small kinase inhibitors. Yeah, some of it's biology, but the therapeutics we created really were driven by the insights we got from the cancer. And so I can't help but believe that a large portion of it is that it really has been the biopharma revolution that has driven cancer medicine from the 90s and the 10s and the teens and the 2000s and the teens. The biopharma didn't invest in pediatrics. Just shows you that fundamental research isn't enough. you need translational research and you need a commitment to clinical development.
Right.
And it can't be done with our traditional funding mechanisms. And so this has led to both pediatrics and rare diseases, for the most part, often being left out in this wave of progress. And so this is where, again, as I'm reflecting on my career, where is the most important contribution that needs to be made? I can't help but think that we can do all the science we want all day long against developing immunotherapies for pediatric cancers. But unless we figure out a way to translate those novel therapeutics efficiently and to register them and get them commercialized, we're going to find ourselves a decade from now saying the same thing.
That's a big challenge, changing biopharma industry that's wholly driven by profit and market size and all of these kind of challenges that are in front of us. But that's why we have governments, right? You have to try to step in for the public good. And how much traction is there now, either in the nonprofit space to help or even at the government level?
Let's be fair. I think everybody wants to help. The question is, will it happen? And there are always challenges like budgets that are flat or contrasting visions for where the most important place is to put the money. I'm very excited about the fact that we brought together a think tank in June of leaders in pediatric cancer and cell and gene therapy to talk about this problem. And talking about the problem is not necessarily soul satisfying, but it is step one. And raising awareness and digesting it into actionable items. So I think we're really at the early stages. But one of the reasons I'm optimistic is others in the field, the Innovative Genomics Institute that Jennifer Doudna leads at UC Berkeley, has also been asking this question, not about children's cancers, but asking how the cures that will no doubt emanate from CRISPR, and I'm going to argue gene therapy writ large, how those are going to be made available regardless of your economic situation. And they're thinking about low and middle income countries, for instance. They put together a task force and have recently read out a paper from that. Many of their same conclusions are our conclusions, that exactly what you mean. I think that part of this is having public monies contribute. Part of this will require nonprofits, and part of it will probably require public benefit corporations. We're not going to change biopharma, but we need to create new structures that will address this problem. And one of the benefits, beyond the obvious of going after children that have brain tumors and offering them a chance for life, is the cost of these therapeutics will go down.
That's true. Yeah.
The model for dealing with this problem right now is to simply recoup the expenses through charging more. We need other ways of dealing with it. And I think there really is a groundswell, at least in raising awareness of the problem, coming up with potential models for solution.
Any kind of field that's, whether it's rare diseases or rare cancer types, or that are is facing the same economic and kind of structural problem, those solutions can be broadly applicable, maybe broadly across the board.
And to take this conversation a little more towards the scientific.
Yeah, sure.
One of the points that I feel strongly about that I'd like to just put out there, and anybody, people probably get tired of hearing it, but it gets back to this issue of how much you learn from the patients. There has been this, I think, desire to get new platforms and new therapeutics into the hands of biopharma early. Right. And let biopharma take it. And there's obviously successes with that. But my opinion is that we need and should do more in the academic arena with early phase trials, small early phase trials with deep data, right? Mm-hmm. 6-12 patients. It's amazing how much you can learn about a new therapeutic. And so back to this comment about translation, for me, yes, it's exciting to take something from the bench to the bedside, but I truly don't believe the clock doesn't even start until you've treated your first patient, because that's when you really start to learn how the thing is going to behave. Sure. And companies, they're often afraid to take risks because they don't get many shots on goal.
It's all about prioritization and safety, you know, risk assessment.
And you need shots on goal because the patients will tell you how they're going to, how it works for them. And I found that cancer patients, those that I develop drugs for, I'm focusing on those conditions where really there aren't any standard therapies. I find that they are more than willing to go into this with me as a partner. They understand what we know. They understand what we don't know. And they're willing to test something new sooner rather than later. I'm all about early translation. I think that academia is where most of this should be happening. And this is where working with the FDA to diminish the regulatory burden, especially for these very early trials that are done by nonprofits, the patients can win, science can win, and it can allow us to get only the best things into biotech.
If this is going to be an experimental medicine setting in academia where you're really diving in, what about the phase zero infrastructure and kind of what we're thinking about and how the FDA should be dealing with this?
The phase zero phases have become almost antiquated. When I started in cancer medicine, a phase one trial was a dose finding trial with no prospect for therapeutic benefit, because if you looked at phase one trials, the response rate was about 2%. Now, if you look at phase one trials, they have pretty darn good response rate because they're targeted and you don't enroll patients who you don't think are going to benefit. So we call them phase one trials, but the truth is, and we are dose finding, but if you don't get a signal on your phase one, it doesn't move forward. So it is got an efficacy component. And phase zero, this idea of just something really early, maybe in the drug arena, that's valuable. I don't find it particularly valuable in cell therapies. But what I want to talk about with the FDA and is understanding that the requirements that are needed to treat half a dozen patients who have no other option and are fully capable of giving informed consent and oftentimes are very well informed should be very different from the requirements to take a drug into thousands of patients. And the truth is, I don't think the FDA is ever going to put those kind of guidelines into a guidance document, because the truth is, it's not going to be across the board. Sure. They're dealing with regulating Stanford University, biopharma, and they're dealing with regulating some guy who opens up an office in Florida or another state somewhere and wants to give stem cell therapy. I get that they're in a tough situation. I think the best thing is to get enough people at the FDA who have enough training so that we can have meetings and not have to wait months. And you develop relationships with your reviewers. And I also believe that checking in on safety will go very far. Give us the leash to treat 6 or 10 patients. If we have safety problems, shut us down. So I would be an advocate of trying to make the case that FDA might feel more confident giving longer leash, especially to academics. But I'm not critical of FDA, because I lived in the government for long enough to know that it's easy to criticize the FDA for being overly careful. But as soon as something goes wrong, all the fingers point at the FDA. I think of them as partners. I do not think of them as barriers.
That's wonderful. And I think that you're right. I think a lot of people are saying the same thing. The problem really is resourcing right now, resourcing talent and giving them the resources that they truly need. And we certainly hope that continues to push forward. When just getting back to the science a little bit, what's the most exciting thing that's happening now in the cell therapy space or just overall in the immunotherapy space for you?
Yeah, I have to say that I am most excited to get these next generation therapeutics into the clinic and see how they behave. We wrote a review for Nature and it came out in February, Luella Bagne, myself, and it forced us, we knew what the landscape, when you do that, you really want to make sure you know everything that's out there. And it's just mind-boggling the possibilities for enhancing the functionality of human immune cells, for enhancing the specificity, for enhancing the regulatability, for combining these with other agents. So the grid is massive. And so for me, where I'm frustrated is all of this is 99% has been done in mice.
Yeah.
So I want to get these next gen therapeutics into patients, and I want to understand how they behave. We're seeing companies like Lyell and Arsenal finally get their clinical trials going, and I just can't wait to see. I want to understand what the toxicities really are that we're dealing with right now. I'm becoming increasingly fascinated with the macrophage axis. I think 5 years ago, it was cytokine release syndrome, right? Everybody thought that was the biggest risk when you're giving cell therapies. But cytokine release syndrome now truly is something that's manageable. It's a very low cause of treatment-related mortality and even morbidity. There is still some neurotoxicity after CAR-19 that I think we need to deal with. But as we move forward, we're seeing this problem of HLH. And what is the biology there? We've got some really exciting data looking at macrophages as agents of T-cell regulation. And maybe where we think this HLH is too many macrophages getting too activated, maybe, or maybe it's that the macrophages are getting outnumbered by the T-cells. And maybe if we make uber potent T-cells, we're going to run into this a lot. But we have an answer for it, right? We have regulatable CARs. We have a system where we can regulate CAR T-cell signaling with small molecule. We've got a synthetic biology system where you can regulate it with an NS3 protease inhibitor. All of these things are really available today to test and respond. But doggone it, the translational apparatus is so doggone slow.
This just leads us to questions about models. The models just aren't sufficient, right? Are they sufficient? I guess is a question to really predict things like the solid tumor toxicity and that kind of thing.
I actually think our efficacy models are better than they used to be. I feel like we have good ways to prioritize what goes into the clinic. So I think that's useful. But I think the toxicity models are terrible.
Super bad.
They're super bad. Cytokine release in the mouse. You have to give the mice all these cells. And we don't even have an ICANS model in mice. And the HLH models, probably it's something I'm hoping my lab will get into a little bit, because I think we need to model that out better.
I think that this is it's something that I think about a lot too, just because if you can't dissociate mechanisms of action and toxicity, you're really in trouble. So if the cells are going in, they're all hyped up, they're making lots of interferon gamma, GM-CSF, everything, and they're liquidating the tumor. I mean, you're clapping and everyone's happy. But what's there is really tissue-associated macrophages that are just seeing interferon gamma and cell death. There's got to be a way, as you said, to use the synthetic biology that we have now to disconnect that conversation a little bit.
This is another kind of point that comes up a lot, where folks are very pessimistic about CAR T cells for solids and the suppressive TME and the trafficking. And I have to tell you, John, I don't really get that, because checkpoint inhibitors work.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
isn't there a suppressive TME in the tumors that get treated with checkpoint? And didn't those T cells traffic there somehow? I don't really get it. But what I think is we haven't had great targets. We haven't put a lot of energy into targets. And when we get something that works, we've taken one step forward and two steps back because of toxicity. And this again gets to the point of the enhancements, right? We're going to need enhancements for solids and probably to enhance even in liquids. But if we don't have a shutoff switch or a way to regulate, we're just going to take two steps back. Yeah. So we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to create enhancements at the same time we're delivering regulatables. One without the other, the PSMA data, it's exciting. But without some way to control the toxicity, it's not going to make it.
Talking about, and the reverse translation, the depth of analysis and immunomonitoring. Yes. Just getting a fundamental understanding of what's going on in that environment. So one just final point, the question is, how do you see this? So cell therapy, and obviously these are the autonomous agents of change, cells in the immune system. So it makes sense to use that. But how do you see combinations of immunotherapy, small molecules, for instance, and to both regulate those cells and to have an impact on tumor? How do you see the combinations of chemotherapy development?
No, that's clearly going to be part of the answer. I've been an oncologist long enough to know the chances you cure a patient with bad cancer with one drug are very low. It can happen. PD-1 inhibition and IPI taught us that, but it's the exception rather than the rule. And every one of us should be looking wherever. And the explosion of targeted therapeutics that happened alongside the development of immunotherapies provides a perfect opportunity. My own personal excitement is around epigenetic modifiers, right? Because clearly we've got lots of those in the toolbox without necessarily, I think, a whole lot of applications in cancers, maybe as we had originally hoped. There are active agents, but I still feel like maybe we aren't using them to the fullest. I'm actually very excited about using drugs to regulate antigen expression. It's not just whether the antigen is there or not. It needs to be there at high enough levels. And these antigens are, their expression is regulated, right? Like anything else. We know that epigenetic modifiers can drive antigen, gamma secretase inhibitors, prevent shedding. There's a whole toolbox, bryostatin, protein kinase C activator, upregulate CD22. That, I think, will be part of the future as well. Drive that antigen.
And that's really speaks directly to mechanisms of resistance, bringing in therapeutics that target exactly that. So I'm tremendously excited by that work too, and really excited by the work that you're doing. So just rounding off, I just wanted to thank you, Crystal, for the tremendous work you're doing here at PICE, but really the amazing advocacy you're doing too for patients.
Yeah, thank you for leading PICE and continuing that great institution. It's done an amazing job of bringing together lots of great people working in the space. And I know it's had a major role in accelerating my research. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside. And special thanks to this season's PICE Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PICE's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify to be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.